step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Welcome back to the Marvel Movie Minute, a daily podcast in which we assemble to explore the films of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, 1 minute at a time. In this, our sixth season, we are looking at The Avengers. I'm Andy Nelson from the Next Real Film Podcast.
And I'm Pete Wright, and it's No Monologue Monday? What?
Today we're talking about Minute 85, which begins with Coulson taking charge and ends with the cage plummeting toward the Earth. Joining us on the show today and for the next few days, we have playwright Dean O'Carroll with us. Hello, Dean.
Hi, guys. Very, very happy to be here.
Great to have you, Dean.
Yeah, it's been so nice to revisit this movie, which I truly love. I'm pretty much completely swallowing the Kool-Aid on the whole MCU, but this one I sort of, because it was, you know, now relatively early on, and you sort of feel like oh well, yeah, they hadn't, you know, gotten it all together yet, and then I revisit it even just a few minutes at a time, like, oh yeah. No, this movie's really, really fun, and I really do love it. So it was so nice to check it out again.
Well, we're thrilled to have you, and new to the show too, which is great. I think we always like to start off this thing with wondering: is there any particular reason that you ended up picking this set of minutes this week?
I was trying to remember. Let's see. I know I do have a 1 minute coming up that I think is very appropriate for me. This one, we were just joking before we started recording that, I'm here as kind of a comedy guy, and here we have the saddest minute in the movie, to start off with, the saddest thing happening to like the nicest, most lovable character. So it's an odd choice for me, a guy who's a comedy playwright by trade to start with this. But I might have just picked it because it's such a dramatic moment and such a memorable moment, kind of a turning point in the movie and debatably in the MCU itself. It's good stuff.
Coulson's last stand. It is a good one. And oh, so here's a fun question: do you think, in the line of who belongs as an Avenger and who doesn't, would you like? Where does the line fall for you? I mean, is Coulson and, I mean, even like Fury, Hill, are they strictly agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.? Are they also Avengers? Like, is there a Venn diagram where kind of they cross over? Like, how would you kind of delineate these characters?
Gosh, I would not call them Avengers. And it's probably because, you know, somewhere within me, there is an 8-year-old boy who's saying, like, they're not wearing costumes. They don't get to be Avengers. You know,
that's where I am, names. Too. Yeah. Like, yeah. Coulson's in a suit. The suit is clearly on the non-Avenger line. He is an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Maria Hill is wearing the leathers.
Yeah.
She's the one that exists in that liminal space, the leather suit liminal space for me. She's wearing the leathers, but she never leaves the ship as far as we see her in this movie. So that, I think, maybe she's an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. She's on that side of the line, but very close. Fury? No, he's not. He's not an Avenger. He's the boss. He does everything else.
Well, he's not in a suit either.
Right, he's not in a suit, but he is also in leathers, Andy. He's got that leather jacket.
Right. I mean, the eye patch sort of drifts towards like mask territory. So
yes,
a little
true.
More sort of iconic of appearance. No, and of course, also, you know, because I'm, you know, the movie is all about bringing me back to my childhood and my love for the comics, that, you know, I can still remember the official handbook to Marvel Universe and who was listed as an Avenger in a little grid of all the headshots of Avengers. And you know, Nick Fury certainly helped them out in some Avengers, but some adventures, but he was never considered.
Yeah, right.
An event.
Right.
That being the original, cigar chomping, white-dimpled
guy. Yeah, right.
Yeah, soldier.
Soldier.
Originally Sergeant Fury.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting line, though. It's like, you know, why? I mean, as we've been joking before, it's like, it's not like they get an official badge welcoming them into the team of Avengers. So it is kind of funny. And it's one of those things where it's like, well, you're an Avenger if you call yourself an Avenger. Or, yeah. And so, but I don't know. It's one of those funny things. And I just like, you know, I like the fact that Coulson is here. He's wielding a ridiculous weapon that's designed from the destroyer, and he's, you know, facing an Asgardian with it. And I'm like, yeah, but he's not an Avenger.
You know what's so great about him, though, is that he wears the suit. He's got the suit and tie, and he's the nerd, right? Like, he's the fanboy nerd. And yet, the way he's written and the way he is, Clark Gregg performs him, he gets to be a badass here, right? Like, his final moment gets to be one of power.
And I was thinking, as I was watching this for today, like, oh, is this the first time we really got to see him do anything action? Because he'd always been, you know, even among S.H.I.E.L.D. agents, he was, like, you know, the guy who seemed to be involved in, like, scheduling. And
yeah, and don't get, Dean, don't get Andy started, because there is a whole, like, sub conversation that we're going to have about Coulson falling downstairs almost and not looking like he's in an earthquake enough. So,
right. And I certainly, you know, I thought of Clark Gregg as a comic actor before this. The only thing I think I knew him from was New Adventures of Old Christine, where he was, you know, kind of a fairly clownish character in that, and was great. I think he's a really good actor, and he can do lots of different things. And I looked it up, and there was that Marvel one-shot short that was packaged with maybe the Thor DVD called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Thor's Hammer, which is a Coulson, where he stops a robbery at a gas station. And so there he is. You know, you do see him, you know, fighting and doing hand-to-hand combat and stuff. So that came out, I guess, a few months before this. So this was not technically the first time anyone had ever seen him being active and involved, though I don't know how many people actually would have seen. I didn't see it until I got Disney Plus.
Yeah. Relatively few.
Yeah, those one-shots, they certainly gave him, well, that one-shot gave him a little more to do. And then obviously by the time he gets through this phase, he gets to jump into Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and he gets plenty of time doing action. And it, clearly, I guess, what they learned from this is they love this character. The audiences really enjoy him. And this is one of those moments, you know, we on this show, we generally call our fair director of this Tig Notaro in honor of the Army of the Dead switcheroo. But this is definitely a trope that he does in his films where, I mean, and stories where take a beloved character, and especially in this film, like really build him up scene after scene with more reasons for the audience to love him. And he is so much our audience surrogate. I can't stand how much I love him, and then kill him. And it's just, it's something that really pulls the rug out from under you. And the old Loki switcheroo that we get here, where Loki is the one who, with his magic, suddenly appears behind him and drives the scepter into his back. I mean, it is a pretty shocking. It plays well.
Absolutely, yeah. Watching it just now, where I see on the small screen, so maybe I didn't see it in enough detail, we don't see the point of the spear coming out of his chest, right?
Correct, we don't.
So we just see the camera just pans a little bit, and we just suddenly see Loki standing behind him with the spear right up in his back. So that means that shot had like no special effects at all. It was just actors and props.
Yeah.
And it's this incredibly powerful moment. And it reminds me, I was thinking, oh, you know, one of the best moments in the original Star Wars is Darth Vader force choking one of the Imperial. And that's no special effects at all. That's just one actor holding his fingers together, another actor pretending to choke. And it's so fantastic. And, you know, and so that was a sudden connection that I made watching it this moment that, you know, the power of it was not required anything fancy.
Well, this is a cinematic trick. I mean, you know, in our other movie show, The Next Reel, we've talked about this cinematic trick quite a bit as far as like filmmakers who purposefully design their frame where if you're not seeing something within the frame, that it kind of doesn't exist in context of the story. It certainly happened in Raider or in the Indiana Jones films. Steven Spielberg uses it a bit. We just were talking about it with Peter Jackson in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And here we have this moment here where nobody can see that Loki is standing. Well, nobody, particularly Thor, can't see that Loki is standing directly behind Coulson, with the scepter ready to plunge it into his back until it's in his back. And it's one of those cinematic tricks that, again, to your point, it is a very effective tool in directing a scene in a way where you don't have to do any effects. You don't have to have anything special. It's just Tom Hiddleston and the scepter are already there. And it's just the way that the camera moves to reveal them. And it creates that surprise. But it is kind of one of those things that I do always wonder. I'm like, where is the magic in all of this? Is like Loki invisible behind him until the scepter is already in him? Like, how does the actual working of it play other than the film making of it?
Because what we know of Loki, right, of the magic stuff that we've seen in when they were at the auction, the symphony auction house Bow Before Zod sequence, is that he can project himself, but there's still one solid Loki. So are we to imagine that the Loki that's having the conversation in front of Coulson, that Coulson's pointing the mysterious destroyer weapon at, is a fake Loki, and the Loki behind Coulson that we don't actually see until later is the real Loki, or is Loki somehow just moving really, really fast?
Well, we do see the one in front of him slowly disappear after he's been stabbed. So so the one standing out there
is the fake one.
Is the fake one.
So presumably the fake one would not have been able to operate the panel that opened the doors to dump Thor out, even though he had just been delivering the, I'm about to kill you speech. That's interesting.
Well, and he doesn't have that. That one doesn't have the scepter either, and so, but this also really more than Stuttgart. This really, I think, plays into the moment in Thor, the Thor film, where they are on Jotunheim, and there is a frost giant charging Loki, who's standing there, and then the frost giant flies through Loki and plummets off a cliff. And then you see that Loki is actually standing behind an icy crop outcropping or something, and makes this other version of himself disappear. But we had seen that was the original Loki first. So I think there has to be some capacity for Loki to disappear himself while keeping a artificial magical version of himself in that exact same spot, and then moving somewhere else and then reappearing. Like, that's, I don't know. It's the only way that I guess it kind of makes sense, because otherwise it does. I don't get it.
I'm telling you, as many times as I've seen this movie, I've never seen him disappear. I've never seen him disappear until just now. And I was about to come at you hard because I thought you were seeing things, but it was me not seeing things.
In the Disney Plus series, he does get into like some of the specifics of the particular spells he can cast and the way he does it. And it's like, oh, why is that there? Why did they include that? Did they feel the need to define these things a bit more? Or did they just feel like Loki should be monologuing about something at this point?
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of Stuttgart, if I go back just a little bit, that is a scene I wish I could have done, because I was fortunate enough to get to work with the actor Ken Tiger, who plays the old man
great.
That scene.
Nice.
He's a great actor. You know, been in things for years and years. Great, working actor. I knew him doing Summer Stock. You know, he was a guy who would do a few TV guest appearances every year, make a perfectly good living from it, and then like go and get to do a play he really wanted to do in Summer Stock during the summer. He's very cool. He's a fun guy and nice to work with.
That's fantastic. Yeah, we had a great time talking about him and reminiscing on his days as the head of the bomb division in the Lethal Weapon films, where he pops up in a couple of those movies. Yes. So, yeah,
I met him. I met his husband, who's a screenwriter, and he mentioned one of the movies that Ken was in was Just One of the Guys, from the 80s. Yeah, and I laughed in a way which I think sounded a little bit dismissive. And then, his husband said, I wrote that movie. And it's like, oh, no, that I think. Like a year later, I sort of apologized. And he said, oh, no, that's fine. I explained that it really was just that I made that connection before, that I instantly remembered the scene because he plays the teacher of the plot premise is this girl disguised herself as a boy to, do an article for the school paper or something. And that early on, he says to the girl as a creepy teacher, like, yeah, you're a pretty girl. You could be a model. And instantly I thought of that. And then, so I was lucky that I was able to unembarrass myself by having a good talk that I was,
That's awesome.
Yes. And he told me that it was he was, I think, one of multiple writers I met, and that it was his idea to actually have her, when she reveals herself to her love interest in that movie, to actually flash her breasts at him. And and I said, well, you adolescent and pre-adolescent boys all over the world for the past 40 years, thank you for that moment.
Right.
Yeah. So funny. That was one of those movies that I probably saw a lot when it was on HBO, because, you know, the summer's just laying around the house. It's just like, oh, this movie's on again.
Yeah.
Yep. That's very fun. The other thing about that I did want to bring up about this is the point where Loki suddenly does have the scepter. We don't see the magical Loki have it here, the one who we thought was the real one who just dropped Thor out of the, or who's getting ready to drop Thor out of the bottom of the ship. So I guess this is a question that, how does he get the scepter out of the Wishbone lab? At what point does that happen? I'm not exactly sure. Like, he's been in here. Did this mercenary? I mean, I guess what could have happened, although it doesn't make a ton of sense, because, I mean, Hulk and Thor have just been destroying the Wishbone lab. Last we saw, you know, Bruce was holding it. He put it back, and then the whole place blows up. And we kind of lose track of it. But then Hulk and Thor end up kind of back in the Wishbone lab through the floor, smashing the place to pieces. The dropship has come down and, you know, was shooting at Hulk, and then Hulk, you know, ended up off the ship. Right before this is where we see Thor run to the detention center, because obviously he thinks something's happening with Loki. But it does make me wonder if this mercenary that's here had been waiting or something. I just don't know exactly how the scepter got from there to here.
Who had, like, the mercenary made off with the scepter from the, like, somehow he snuck into the Wishbone lab?
I guess. I mean, it's never explained. And then he would have to have gotten it either before Hulk and Thor start destroying it, or after they've left. But then if it was afterward, he'd have to race Thor to get here in time. And that doesn't make a lot of sense.
That doesn't make sense either.
I don't know. Now I feel like I need to go back to those scenes and see, do I see the scepter laying around? Yeah.
Yeah, because the last time I saw it in anybody's hands, it was Banner's, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
And we don't ever see Loki having any ability to sort of conjure it or, like, summon it the way that Thor can summon Mjolnir, right?
No.
He does have to just pick it up with his hands.
Yeah.
Anytime he wants to use it, yeah.
Exactly, exactly.
Unless part of his magic is he essentially teleports himself there. Picks it up and teleports back.
Well, I mean, that is, you know, as he says in the Thor film, he has access to these back doors. So, you know, it's entirely possible there was some way that there was some backdoor thing that he went through to get in here and grab it.
He's all about those variants. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Who knows? It's just one of those tricky things that I think that they kind of just gloss over. And the fact that, you know, oh, he just magically appeared back here and he has the scepter. So it's just like, they just kind of write it in a way where it's like, you know, you just kind of assume that somehow magic worked. You know, you got a magical character and it's easy to write. Maybe a little too easy to write things off.
I mean, I suppose it didn't even really have to be the scepter for this particular act. It could have been any pointy object, you know, and to the back would have taken him out.
Well, especially with Loki. I mean, this is a character who's always conjuring blades and throwing them at people.
Yeah.
That's a good point. I think it would have made more sense.
Well, I guess they just needed to get the scepter back into his hands so that he has it for later.
And the moment, so what happens next in this minute is the, you know, I made the joke that this is a non-monologuing minute, but I actually really like this. I think this is a solid way to handle this particular sequence, because Loki, real Loki, now has the scepter, and Thor is visibly upset and angry enough that when he slams his hand on the glass of the cage, of the cell, he's able to crack it. And Loki opens the purge hole at the bottom of the helicarrier and without a word pushes the red button. And I think that was a smart choice here, that we have no sarcastic lines, we have no smartass remarks, there's no nothing. It's just a look between these two performers and the purge. I think that's a really nice touch. And I think, to the point of the scepter, having Loki holding the scepter is a final poke in the eye for Thor, that it's a statement that I won. I got what I wanted. Hulk's gone crazy. He's destroying this helicarrier. And now, excuse me, you're going down. I'm going to go get in a jet.
It's an interesting moment, the way that it plays. And it is, I do, to your point, I like that it is dialogue free between the brothers as Thor realizes what's happened. They've exchanged these looks, and Loki's just ready to do it and ready to drop Thor. And this is yet another instance of the two of them doing things to each other as only brothers can do, I suppose.
Yeah. Like, this is one of those, is there anything left to be said moments?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Loki did get his quip. He did get, you know, they think we're immortal. Let's test that out.
Yeah.
Right. Before this, you know, when he possibly in illusionary form was just about to do this, he did have the one liner. In my notes, I did say, like, what is he thinking? Do I need to come up with another zinger before I kill my brother now?
Yeah, right, right.
Or do I just press the button?
But after the death of Coulson, I don't think there is room for another, like, emotionally in the beat of the scene, there's no room for another zinger.
No. Yeah, I don't think so. That does make me laugh, though, and think, like, if Coulson hadn't interrupted and this was just the conjured version of him, he says that line and then he's just like, just wait 1 second. And while I wait for the real version to get back here, so that he can push the button. Because I can't quite.
I don't have fingers.
I have a few alts for that last joke. I'll run those by everyone.
Oh my gosh.
Always hopeful that maybe his, you know, Loki will turn around. Maybe he will, you know, he will see the light and not do this, you know, up until the last moment, even after he's killed Coulson, it's still there. I like the more ridiculous, you know, clown Thor that he evolved into, and Hemsworth obviously is very good at that. But I did like the more serious and noble Thor of these first few movies too, before he got quite so clownish. You know, and that's much more of the Thor that I grew up with that I did love.
Right, the one that when they would write his dialogue, it was all the flowery lettering.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah, right.
Just a note about this weapon that he's holding. Actually, I have more about the weapon. I want to talk about it when Phil actually gets to use it. But I did just want to say, I was curious. I'm like, is this, because we've been talking a lot about phase two and how, like, all this Hydra, this Tesseract technology that Hydra had been developing is what is part of phase two, and that the design of it is to protect against these aliens and things that, you know, as Fury, you know, he kind of points to Thor in that earlier conversation. And so I was wondering, does this weapon that was designed from the destroyer, does it actually count as part of phase two, or is it something else? And according to the wiki, this is actually part of phase two. The way that they encapsulate all of this is that they say phase two is aimed to develop new technologies capable of offering humanity some incredible defense in the face of threats on the level of the destroyer or the abomination. So,
Does he say that it's taken from the destroyer, or that it started building it after they had to deal with the destroyer?
He says that we started working on the prototype after you sent the destroyer, but the wiki actually breaks that down a little more. And, you know, when he uses it, I have kind of all the stuff written out as far as, like, what the wiki says, as far as, like, how they were, what they were doing and stuff. So
now, theoretically, since the Tesseract was asleep for 70 years, anything that they've built from Tesseract tech has to have been built relatively recently, right? Unless they were just repurposing, you know, scavenged Hydra tech from World War II.
Well, when we see Captain America bring the weapon in earlier, it is actually an old weapon from World War II.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean they're not working on other things. It's just, for some reason, at this point, they're not. It just seems like they want to be. They're trying to figure out the Tesseract. That's a story issue I have, because clearly Zola had already figured it all out, and he was already creating a lot of weapons with Tesseract energy. Why is S.H.I.E.L.D. taking so long to figure this out, especially since Zola and Hydra are kind of a part of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Yeah. So you have to wonder. So was, you know, when Zola was, you know, was working for S.H.I.E.L.D., was it always like, hey, why haven't you built us this Hydra tech, And is it the answer, like, I can't because the Tesseract's asleep? I could, you know, do everything but accept whatever the Tesseract could give me back in 1942. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, because, I mean, it doesn't take that long to get the Tesseract from the bottom of the ocean, as we see in the end of Captain America.
Yeah, it's actually quite easy.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so I don't know if it is asleep or exactly what is going on with it, but it's just they don't do anything with it. They kind of, you know, put it away. And it seems like they forget about it until, I mean, there is that brief bit it has with the Flurkin and everything in the 90s. But otherwise, it's like, I guess it's in a box until Puerto Antiguo in the Thor movie when they realize, hey, we better take that thing out and start doing something with it. Yeah, the timeline's a little, like, as needed, sort of, you know?
Yeah, and I wonder if we're ever going to be told, like, oh, you know, here's why it woke up in 2012. You know, is there, you know, we have some outside forces acting on it, like, oh, you know, now it's time for it to wake up because now it knows Earth is actually ready to, you know, the age of heroes has begun or whatever it is. You know, they could throw any number of possible explanations for that if they felt the need to.
That's true.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows? Well, this minute, we do see Thor dropping again. I love the way that, like, just all of the CG creations of this cell falling through the ship and then falling out the bottom of the helicarrier and just kind of dropping, and it kind of goes silent other than the sounds of wind. I mean, it's just great the way that they put all this together. You definitely see the shot of the coast below, which is kind of cool to see. It does make me wonder, as I'm watching it, is Thor going to hit the water or is he going to hit the land? Could be either. It's kind of 50-50 at this point.
Yeah.
Andy, the last time we talked about the hole in the hull was when they were just, it was the Fury tour. And you expressed some concern about the ultimate design of the hole in the hull. Is it better in action now that you see how it works?
I don't think I have a specific issue with how it works. I mean, what we see here is kind of like that, the iris floor. Mm-hmm. I guess it must be toward the bottom of the ship, right? I'm assuming. And then it has the cell has those rails that it just kind of slides down and then falls out the bottom. And we don't see it from these shots, unfortunately. But when we first saw it, when Fury was looking at it, it looked like a series of catwalks that people could potentially be standing on. They're in this
totally
hallway
exposed.
And they're all exposed. Like, you know, if this thing opens, they're just going to get sucked right out the bottom. And that was, I think, the biggest concern that I had, is that it's like, I don't know how much that really makes sense. But
yeah, well, and if it lands while somebody happens to be walking around, hopefully they would know. But there's just a lot. It feels like the way when they give us these exterior, interior, exterior shots, it feels like there's just a lot of exposed underbelly that they're showing from these close-up sequences, like these actual action sequences, that when you're looking at the, you know, when the ship goes invisible, you're looking at a big wide shot of it in flight, you can't see. Like, I have no clue where to actually position this purge hole in the bottom of the ship when we're looking at it on a different angle.
Well, we see it. Like, it comes out, and it's like, next to, it's just kind of to the side of what looks to be the, I guess it's not necessarily the Wishbone Lab, but it could be the bridge. The bridge is right there at the bottom, because you see that hole, like right about second 56, you can see the hole where it comes out. And it's not centered. Like, my brain always said that it was centered, like along the central axis. I guess it might be centered, you know, kind of across the ship, but it's not from front to back.
I see the hole. Yeah, you're right. It's not centered, but you could see all the exposed gearing underneath the ship. What happens to that stuff?
I don't think that's exposed gearing. Well, that's either the wishbone, like that entire hole where the Wishbone Lab is, and it's all windows, or because you can't tell from this angle, or is that kind of the bubble of all the windows that makes up the bridge?
That makes up the underbelly bridge.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's still weird. I'm not letting go of that.
It's the whole design is weird. Again, they've got giant holes in all the windows. They can't land in the ocean now. I don't know how they're going to fix all this stuff.
Because they shot themselves.
So many things with this thing, but
yeah.
All right.
All right.
Well, Thor is falling. Loki is happy. He's dropped his brother. That's pretty much where this minute ends. So let's wrap things up. We'll be back tomorrow with you, Dean, to talk about minute 86. So thank you so much, first of all, for joining us here today.
Absolutely. So glad to be here.
Tell everybody about what you do in this world of of writing plays that might tie in some capacity to this.
They just might by staggering coincidence. Yes. Yeah. So I write plays mostly, but the plays that I write get produced by like high school and middle school drama clubs, and summer camps and community theaters and so on. And sort of the niche that I've carved myself is writing parodies of big pop culture franchises. So I have a few plays that parody the Harry Potter books, and I've got a Star Wars one and a parody of Back to the Future. And sure enough, what a coincidence. I do happen to have one based on the Marvel movies, and this one in particular. And it's called Marvelous Squad. The full title is Marvelous Squad, a superheroic tale with a vengeance. And so it is a parody mostly of the first Avengers movie, though I do use scenes from some of the other early films too. And then there are cameos by pretty much everybody who winds up being an Avenger by the time of Endgame. In there. And so I do have an equivalent scene to the death of Coulson, where my character is sort of a mix of Coulson and Maria is named Piper because of the old expression that relaying exposition is called laying pipe. And so since that's sort of her job in the play, and she does not die, but my version of Nick Fury, whose name is Nikki Fitz, realizes that this is a moment to try to convince the heroes that Piper is going to die and they need to avenge her. So it's a bit of a Monty Python I'm not dead yet, yes you are type of moment in the play.
Oh, so fun. So
that's
fun.
Awesome.
Well, we will have links to all of Dean's socials and sites, and you can check out his play there in our show notes. So just check those out in your podcatcher, or if you're not seeing them there, you can go to our website, marvelmovieminute.com, and look at it all right there. That's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow with Minute 86. So, Pete, thanks as always.
Mandy, tomorrow, more catwalk.
Mm-hmm. Until next time, true believers.
Marvel Movie Minute is a production of True Story FM, engineering by Andy Nelson. This season's music is Message to the World by Anthony Vega, and this season's show art is by Winston Yabo. Find the show at truestory.fm. If your podcast app allows ratings and reviews, please consider doing that for our show.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.